When we think of war and refugees, we think about places far away. But battles and displaced people were very much a part of the landscape in our part of the world more than a century and a half ago. White settlers and Native Americans fought over the land in Oregon and California, eventually driving tribal members to reservations. It's not a happy period in history, but one that needs to be understood. Our first guests today look for greater understanding, largely through excavation, looking for the places where key events took place and what those sites might reveal about the so-called Indian Wars in the region. Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov are both scientists and teachers at Southern Oregon University and work through the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, hereinafter constantly referred to as SULA. Mm-hmm. Mark Tveskov, good to have you back on The Exchange.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Chelsea Rose, good to see you again, too.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
So is the job that you do somewhat easier in that you're focusing on events that occurred less than 200 years ago? I mean, you don't have to dig quite as deep to find stuff like that.
I think it's a richer experience because we have so many things to work with. We have diaries and documents and newspaper accounts that somebody working 5,000 years ago doesn't have, in addition to the material things, the things that people made and used that you find through archaeological excavation. So it's like a very rich tapestry of material to paint pictures of what happened in the past.
I hadn't even thought about the fact that you even have photographs of
and even
of people
photographs
and places
of people.
From the time. Yeah,
that's right.
So what's the overall plan here? I mean, where did this begin, and is there an ultimate end to it? Is it just to keep digging until we find everything we can possibly find?
It'll never end. Well, it began for us with the excavations at Fort Lane, which was the U.S. Army fort here in the Rogue Valley during the Rogue River Wars. And that led us to thinking about one of the battles that the soldiers at Fort Lane engaged in, which was the Battle of Hungry Hill, which was a pretty serious defeat for the Army in the fall of 1855. And in doing that work, we've developed a number of partnerships with state agencies and federal agencies and many of the Western Oregon Indian tribes that made us think that there's a lot of work to be done on the Rogue River Indian Wars. And like you said in your introduction, it's like to try to flesh out the picture and gain a better understanding. And it does have a lot of contemporary relevance with refugees and cultural displacement and the like.
So Chelsea, what are some of the rich troves thus far? We talked about Fort Lane and the Battle of Hungry Hill, but there's some other places. I mean, at the beginning of a project like this, do you even have to kind of figure out where it is you're going to start looking?
Yes, we have to figure out where we need to look, but also we've started to think about this as a landscape level effort because it's the landscape of war. And this story can't be told through one of these sites specifically. It has to be told in conjunction because there's so many different stakeholders in this conflict. And so one of the things that's been really exciting, like Mark said, we started with the military. So you have the complexities within, you know, Fort Lane being the enlisted men versus the officers versus the people that they're there to protect, the Native Americans. But then you also have this battle site and the two people on those sides. And again, these aren't battles with front lines. These are kind of guerrilla-type warfare where the landscape itself is used as a weapon, which is really fascinating. But then now our newest project is going to be on the coast, and we're looking at it from the pioneer side, so the settler side and their role and their, you know, the way that they experience this conflict as well. So it's been really exciting to kind of start to see it from a more scaled back view, which I think is a more accurate view.
Bunch of things jumped out in what you just said. First of all, you said there are so many stakeholders here. So it's not just us versus them. It was more than just side A versus side B.
Yeah. I mean, this was complex. A lot of people had their own agendas. The gold miners had specific agendas. The settlers that came here in the 1850s settled on Native American land. This was the Oregon Territory. This wasn't American land definitively at that point. So, and then of course the military had their agenda. So, and then the Native Americans, and not just one group. There's lots of different groups. So there's a lot of different perspectives, and this landscape covered most of the state of Jefferson, these wars, especially on the Oregon side, you know, so it's a huge area. And Mark, you can probably elaborate a little bit more on that.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things that comes out when you study a topic like this for a long time is people tell stories, and they tell stories that reflect their agenda. And the story of the Rogue River War was told mostly in the Victorian era by pioneer descendants who, or the pioneers themselves, who wanted to tell the story in a specific way. And it was a way that left out many of these stakeholders, which is the word we're using here, and almost literally whitewashed the story to some extent. So some of the diversity of perspectives that were represented in the war were left out. For example, the role of women, both pioneer women and Native American women. And today happens to be
International Women's Day.
That's today, right. Really? Wow.
And this project, the next phase of our project is to work on a site, the Geisel Homestead, which was on the Oregon coast, and it was where a German family, the Geisels, settled in 1854. And Mr. Geisel was killed at the outbreak of the Rogue River War. And Mrs. Geisel was taken captive, and she was eventually ransomed back to the pioneers through the agency of an Indian woman who was married to a white man. And if you read any standard textbook that describes the Rogue River War, it describes the great effort that this white pioneer, his name was Charlie Brown, went through to secure the release of Mrs. Geisel. But if you read between the lines with a little bit of cultural understanding of the role that Native women played, it was the agency of this woman that secured this woman's release, Mrs. Geisel.
So a woman helped negotiate the release of another woman.
Yeah. The pioneers were basically besieged inside of a fort on the coast of Curry County right outside of Gold Beach. It's called Miner's Fort. And Mrs. Geisel was being held captive. And inside the fort were several Indian women married to these pioneer men. And one of these couples, went out of the fort into quote-unquote hostile Indian territory and secured the release of Mrs. Geisel. And historians have always wondered about that and about the bravery of Charlie Brown in doing this and how come he wasn't killed. And it was because it was the deals being made by his Indian wife.
Mark Tveskov and Chelsea Rose are from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology researching the Indian Wars of Southern Oregon in the 1850s. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You know, it seems like you end up researching some really fundamental questions, because as you pointed out, the stories that white settlers are going to tell their kids 30, 40, 50 years later are going to mm-hmm. be perhaps a little different from what actually happened. I mean, mm-hmm. can we even get to root things like who started it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And who started it is still a matter of debate. We have these debates when we do the research among our colleagues to this day. And yeah, it's really difficult to get at some of those root causes.
And often, I mean, there were skirmishes back and forth, it sounds like, and some were considered reprisals for earlier ones. I mean, you get layers of he did it, he did it, he did it, back and forth, don't you think?
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, one of the first times I was on your show, I was talking about Fort Lane and the start of the Rogue River Wars. And I got an email from somebody who was a pioneer descendant who said his great-grandfather was killed on the Siskiyou Summit by those Indians and was very angry at me for how I presented that conflict on your show, right?
Really?
And it was a matter of who started that final war, that final battle.
And when you think about that, this is again a very complex interaction between a lot of different people, because even before anybody formally declared war, the pioneer trails coming through the Applegate Road or the Applegate Trail coming through is impacting wildlife passages, muddying streams, doing all these things that are impacting the Native Americans who lived here and, you know, disrupting things. So even if people passing through didn't think that they were going to settle here or they weren't trying to, you know, mess with anybody, their actions had a negative impact on the folks living here. So by the time you get the gold rush and then a huge wave of people coming in, you know, it's hard to say, you know, who started it, because there's a big group of people that come in and they've got this manifest destiny idea, and they're not necessarily asking permission or trying to be collaborative in every instance. Some are, but you know, so there's actions that kind of, you know, have violence as a consequence without maybe that being their intention.
That's a really interesting way to think about it, that even if the people were left unmolested, the things that they expected to have in certain places, mm-hmm. in certain conditions were damaged, were mm-hmm. changed by white settlers passing through. Fort Lane itself, something you had said earlier, Chelsea, about protecting Native Americans. What was the actual function of Fort Lane?
Well, it was stationed just outside of the Table Rock Indian Reservation, which was the first on the West Coast?
One of the very first reservations made in the American West. It was a new process.
And, you know, and a lot of times the way we think about the Rogue River Indian Wars, like you said, is us versus them or the whites versus the Indians or, you know, and it's not that. And in many cases, the military, the Fort Lane folks were actually working more on the side of the Native Americans against some of these volunteer militias that were maybe acting out of school. You know, they were getting all riled up and not serving the best interest of the area. And so, you know, it wasn't just whites versus Native Americans at all. There was a lot of different, you know, again, agendas going on.
I sense another federal agency caught in the middle of something again.
Yeah, and there's a lot of parallels to current events around the role of the federal government. In the 1850s, a good portion of the Oregon pioneers in Southern Oregon were members of what was called the Know-Nothing Party, which very much parallels today's Tea Party and some of the agenda they had of having their local rights. Like, they wanted to be able to say what they wanted to be able to do on a local level and not have the federal government be part of their lives. It's a very parallel situation.
We're talking about Indian history, Native American history in Southern Oregon and clashes with whites, as documented by the folks at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. Mark Tveskov and Chelsea Rose are guests on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join in. Questions or comments, welcome. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Are there good accounts of these wars, written accounts from the Native American side from that period? I mean, were there surviving accounts that made it up to the Siletz Reservation, for example?
There are, Siletz and Grand Ronde. There are many family accounts of being removed from Southern Oregon and recalling the places that where they were from. What there aren't are very specific accounts of what exactly happened in the battle. I mean, I think that they were very busy and it was a very traumatic time. There are a couple of very interesting and specific accounts of the war, however. For example, the Battle of Hungry Hill that we have done a lot of work. A Takelma woman named Frances Johnson was a young woman, and she was in that battle. And she was somebody who passed on many of her stories to contemporary generations. And she specifically remembers being in that battle and listening to hearing the bullets whiz by her head. And a quote, a story she told was to her family over the years was that at the end of the battle, which was a victory for the Indians, she always said that, "You bet your life that night I danced around a white man's scalp."
Hmm. So the Battle of Hungry Hill, you found the site within the last couple of years, is that right?
Yep. In 2012, I think, is when we finally nailed down the location.
And what was the major difficulty in finding it?
Well, it's a kind of a long story, but basically I think that people didn't want to remember it because they got beat. You know, in the pioneer memoirs, they sort of describe it as a victory. But if you really dig deep into those stories and the archaeology of it, it was clearly a pretty resounding defeat. And many in their private correspondence, many of the participants on the white side said, you know, all things considered, we just assume forget this ever happened. And it was out in a very remote location out in the mountains. And, you know, it just fell by the wayside.
Members of several different tribes against the, was it militia and army?
Yeah, it was a joint force of militia and U.S. Army soldiers against Native American people from the Rogue River Valley and the Umpqua Valley.
So was Hungry Hill the name of the place, or was it something that got assigned because of the battle itself?
Because of the battle itself, the white American forces went out there expecting a quick victory, and they found themselves in way over their heads and were besieged and trapped there for 2 days with no supplies. So they remembered it as the Battle of Hungry Hill because they didn't have anything to eat.
Was that particular battle unusual in different tribes working together militarily? Had that happened before? Do we know?
In Southern Oregon, what was different about it was it was different because many different groups of Native American people in Southern Oregon joined together. And that was because of, just like it was different because how the army and the militia worked together. And it was all this underlying tension that just came to a head in a very violent way in a very brief moment in time.
We have a call on the line. Grab your headphones there, Mark. And this is Charlie in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov from SULA.
Good morning, folks. Yes, I've always been interested in Captain Jack and the Modoc Indian Wars, having read many, many years ago Joaquin Miller's Unwritten History, and his, you know, whether it was all high talk or not, of him uniting the tribes in one great alliance. I think it was like the Modocs and the Pitt River Indians and maybe the Shastas that he was going to attempt to unite. Anyway, I've always been interested in that whole thing, and maybe you could shed some light on that. Plus, if possible, the rumors and tales of a lost Army payroll down in the Mount Wasson lava beds that was supposedly robbed at the time of the Indian War.
All right.
With the Modocs. Any thoughts on that?
All right. Thanks for that, Charlie.
Well, in the Modoc War happened a decade or so after the Rogue River Indian War, and some of the underlying causes were very similar, and that was east of the mountains from here. And one of the idea of an alliance between many Native American groups was something that the pioneers feared more than anything else. The political structure, the traditional political structure of Native American people was to live in basically independent bands who were united by culture rather than politics. But when you read the pioneer stories of the Modoc War and the Rogue River War, the hawks in that situation consistently raised the boogeyman of all the Native Americans were going to rise up as one against us. And historians have debated whether or not how much that was true in both the Rogue River War and the Modoc War. And it seems like there were some Native leaders who did have that idea in their head, but whether or not they could actually make that happen in the long run is another question altogether. In the case of the Modoc War, you know, it was restricted to several bands of the Modoc who had legitimate grievances against the government in terms of why they wanted to resist going on to the Klamath Reservation. The story of the lost Army payroll is an interesting one. It sounds like a buried treasure tale more than anything, which are always sort of pie-in-the-sky kinds of ideas, but you never know.
It seems like there's the lost Nazi gold, the last of the Civil War. Every war seems to end with some last shipment of gold getting lost someplace.
Yeah, if there's a crazy story recently of a Nazi treasure train stuck in a mountain in Poland, which turned out to be like completely nothing. And I think those are myth tales that we like to tell more than anything, although, like I said, you never know.
Well, that brings up a question, because in addition to accounts that either were scrubbed or just didn't get accounted because people didn't want to talk about it, how much does Western literature give you a layer that you have to penetrate to get to the truth of what happened here because of all the cowboy and Indian tales that we seem to love so well from the 1870s on?
Well, that's a great point, because that's something we're really thinking about with this Geisel story, because there's a genre of American literature called a captivity narrative that derived from colonial America during the early wars where colonial women were kidnapped by Native American people during the King Philip's War. This is back in the 1600s. And when they came back, they worked with their preacher, their Puritans, and they wrote these captivity narratives, and they were moral tales about Christian redemption in the hands out there in the wilderness. And that's a literary genre. Every American literature textbook starts with those things. And when the Indian Wars reached Oregon, the Geisel story is a version of that. So even though it was a real historical event where Mrs. Geisel's husband was killed in front of her and she and her daughters were kidnapped by the Indians, the people at the time and ever since have translated that story in terms of this cultural meme of the captivity narrative and turned it into a moral tale. And it's the same thing here in the valley with the Harris cabin, Mrs. Harris, who was burned, her cabin was attacked in the same war. And in other words, it's like a moral tale about the suffering of the pioneers at the hands of the savages in order to redeem their place in the wilderness. And you have to, and that's an interesting story in and of itself, and one that you have to delve through to get at historical fact.
We have an email here from Kyle, who calls himself a son of Oregon. He says, please ask about the evidence of Native civilization dating back 9,000 years in the Rogue Valley and why the archaeological sites controlled by the BLM, such as Rogue River Ranch, have not had a proper archaeological study done.
Native American people have lived in southern Oregon for at least 14,000 years, according to archaeological research. And the oral tradition of the Native American people of southern Oregon place their origins in our region back since time began, as they like to phrase it. So there's a lot of mysteries for sure about the history of our region, but Native Americans are certainly part of it for as long as we can all conceptualize on some level. Rogue River Ranch is an interesting place that has a pretty extensive archaeological record, and Oregon State University conducted research there in the 1980s. And that was one of the key sites that scientists, anyways, used to document the persistence and long-term use of our region by Native Americans. That's a pretty amazing place archaeologically.
Now, to the story of the Geisel family and some of the other events on the Oregon coast, I noticed you guys are going to be taking students out to the coast this July. Chelsea, tell us about Summer Field School.
Yeah, so our next big push, like we said, was to look at this Pioneer Fort and Fort Minor, and then also the Geisel, which is the Geisel Monument, which was where their house was, and that's a state park. And so we are going to do a month-long field school in July, and we're going to bring students out there, and we'll have a couple public days and invite people out to come see what we're finding. And we're hoping to really use this big effort to, really dive in deep and answer some of these questions about this side of these interactions, so the pioneer side. And again, like Mark said, it's really cool because we have some documentation that's a little bit different than the military side. So we know that women were involved. We know families were there. And so this will be, the remnants of these other players in this conflict.
When I think about the way most of us approach things, like the monument you said where the Geisel House was, that, we just read them and we drive on. And I just wonder if you guys as archaeologists and anthropologists occasionally roll your eyes at the accounts on those monuments and they go, oh boy, if only they knew.
Yeah.
And I think when we see these kind of landscapes, like, we're able to see this whole other layer over it because we can kind of reconstruct what, the archaeology that we see, looks like the pristine land to the untrained eye. So sometimes it's really exciting to be able to then get the tools to translate that to the public. And then, and that's definitely one of the things that'll come out of this is we'll have a lot more information so that when you go to the Geisel Monument next time you're driving up the coast, you can see the results of the excavation. Where was the house, And the thing that's so exciting about archaeology is because all of these records we've been talking about, they're all biased. They are also artifacts. But the actual artifacts that end up in the soil, and when you start to kind of tie all these things together, those are the unbiased results of the choices people made, the opportunities they had, and the conflicts they were part of.
So the ground doesn't lie.
The ground doesn't lie.
All right. We have a final email here from Bruce in Happy Camp. As I eat pizza in a shop in Happy Camp, I realize that many of the people around me are part Native American and part settler or pioneer miners. The times of us and them, whites and Indian, are over. It's time to embrace our past and move on together. So there's a vote in favor of what you're doing.
Nice.
Yeah, great.
Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov are from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. The Landscapes of War is the summer field school for students, those lucky students, this July near Gold Beach. Thank you both for joining us again in the exchange.
It's our
Thanks
pleasure.
For having us.